In our practice, there's a couple broad different ways of how we hold the mind and hold the practice. It was yesterday afternoon, Ajahn Kurundamo was talking about the using anicca, dukkha, anatta, the impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, not self. And this is traditionally the kind of the way of holding of attention or directing attention, which is a basis for insight. The other broad way of holding attention is for the settling of the mind in states of tranquility and concentration. And of course, there's no kind of hard walls between these different practices, and we have to develop skill in applying the mind in both ways, and we have to recognize when is appropriate and useful to encourage the mind to be settled, to be peaceful, to be tranquil, to be still, using the objects of tranquility, which generally are the different meditation objects that we develop and sustain attention on, that help to cool and settle the mind, and allowing the mind to become still within itself. With the practices of insight, then we need to lift up the mind to contemplation, investigation, exploring themes of Dhamma that help us to see more clearly, understand principles of Dhamma, discern our experience and the phenomena both internally and externally in ways that help to clarify and lead to a deeper understanding that allows us to relinquish the basis of our attachments and biases within the mind. Having said that, of course, according to our temperament and according to what's working for us at different times, sometimes we need to be paying attention to the aspects of tranquility, of settling, of stilling, and then the insights kind of follow somewhat naturally. Sometimes we have to use the mind, apply the mind with that investigation, analyzing, using the power of discernment to clarify things, And in that, sort of with that power of discernment and insight leading, then the mind becomes settled and still. And sometimes it's, you know, they go hand in hand. So it's up to us to experiment and see what works. And of course, what works is what brings brings suffering to an end. One of the things that that we do need to pay attention to is that when we use a criterion of, say, like stillness, we have to pay attention to what happens to that stillness. Say when we when there's contact of the senses or contact with people, the world around us. This is something that Ajahn Chah really emphasized, in the sense that, say, this the stillness of samadhi is, of course, it's delicious. It's required. I mean, we need to learn how to bring the mind to a place of cool and clarity. But oftentimes what happens is when we have contact with the senses, or we experience things that we like or dislike, then the mind loses its stillness. And Ajahn Chah really emphasized that for the Dhamma to be really manifesting itself, the stillness of insight should be, or the stillness that arises out of a true insight would result in, when we contact that which is pleasurable or not pleasurable, the mind is steady and clear. When we contact the things that we're have a propensity to like or dislike, that stillness is present. It's not shaken. So to recognize one that is a possibility. That is it's a goal. It's a an aspiration, and the that sense of finding a stillness within conditions. Because as long as we have a body, a mind, we're living, breathing beings, we're in contact with others, we're living within the conditions of the world. But it is possible, and that's the purpose of the Buddhist teachings, to experience and dwell in a stillness within those conditions. It isn't about finding perfect conditions, because if you wait for the perfect conditions for your practice, so that everything will be just right, and then you'll really be able to practice, then we'll be doing the cremation ceremonies first. There really isn't such thing as absolutely perfect conditions. But there is, on an external level, but on an internal level, we can find a place of stillness within the conditions that we're engaged in. And that's the function of insight, the function of our developing the skills of tranquility, so that they work together, but culminating in an insight of that fundamentally changes the mind. And sometimes it's and you see it in increments. I mean, that's for all of us. Many of the people here, majority probably that are here, have been practicing actually for quite a long time. And the reason why we keep doing it is we see change that takes place within us. We see us changing. Things that used to disturb or shake us, we get a handle on more. We see the fruits, we see the benefits, and the practice is nourished by that seeing. And this is one of the actually one of the kind of encouragements that Ajahn Mun used to give his students all the time. And Ajahn Chah would similarly use that. And as an idiom that's used, but sort of like being a witness for oneself, sort of having an inner witness that sees and experiences the truth, is able to, so that we're either not doubting ourselves, not second-guessing ourselves, not confusing ourselves, but having that inner witness that sort of having that one who knows within. And of course that's the function of the Dhamma, chanting when we do the chanting, recollecting the qualities of the Dhamma. Sandhittiko, it's apparent here and now. This is the nature of this teaching, the nature of the truths that the Buddha is pointing to. These are apparent here now. We can, they're accessible. It's not sort of hidden behind some impossible veils of some that you need some either mystical ceremony or something to access it, or somebody else to intervene for you. It's apparent here now. And then pachatang vedita bovinyuhi, to be experienced for each wise person for themselves, so that we can experience this. We have to apply our wisdom. Having this inner witness and tapping into it, learning how to trust it, this quality of knowing, is when we knowing and recognizing the nature of our experience. The characteristics of existence, anicca and dukkha anatta, can't be emphasized enough, that we bring our attention back to these universal characteristics. In Pali, it's sort of tilakana, sort of the the three characteristics of existence. And there's a couple lists in the and the, I mean, a couple lists. There's tons of lists in the Buddhist teachings. he was a great list maker, there's a couple lists, and actually neither they're commentarial compilations. One is the list of the insight knowledges and the lists of the defilements of insight. The one, vipassana upakilesa, sort of the defilements of insight. And of course, I can't remember everything in these lists, but just in the general, the defilements of insight are around light, sort of radiance, when the mind is radiant, upasa, the radiance of mind, unremitting energy, steady mindfulness, all of the things you're looking for. And so, what? These are the defilements of insight. And then the insight knowledges are these boring. Everything's impermanent. All the conditions, the whole world is sort of ceasing, seeing the dukkha in everything. I said, those are the insight knowledges. I said, well, that's interesting, because it goes counter, of course, to what we want. It's recognizing the natural tendency of the mind. The natural tendencies of the mind are that it's easy to get lost in the pleasant, in the beautiful, in the sublime, and it wakes us up when we experience the transitory nature of things, when we experience the disappointing aspect of the conditions, when it doesn't fulfill our expectations, so that. That leads to a relinquishment, so that these are shied away from, but to be held in a way of taking interest and letting the mind experience the fruits of that when we do investigate these natural characteristics, these kind of laws of how of existence. When we pick up the anicca, then there is a and Ajahn Kurundomo mentioned it yesterday, that say an alter, usually it's translated as impermanence, and Ajahn Chah's been translating it as inconstancy, which is, a word we don't really use that much, but it's I think it's helpful to reflect on, because there is a when we think of impermanence and we think of change, which is I mean, it is a true reality, but then it's also sort of trying to tap into what's our habit of mind? And our habit is sort of looking for what is constant. What is it that gives us some kind of security? And we seek that in external conditions or the internal conditions of the mind as well, which is still external from our perspective. So we seek that constancy, we seek that security, so that reflecting on inconstancy. The way that Ajahn Chah oftentimes expressed it would be as uncertain. He would use that, you know, as often or sometimes more often than that the pointing to, the, say, like change or impermanence. He'd point to the uncertainty, unsure, because that's how we experience it. When if we reflect on something as impermanent, oftentimes, say, what we do is it becomes an object and then external to us. When we reflect on something as uncertain, then it's just, that's how we tend to experience it or how it feels to us. So that paying attention to how it feels to us, because something can be true, but it doesn't really, we don't take it in. So that bringing that in and paying attention to that quality of uncertain, of unsure. There is a certain level of discomfort there. When we experience that change, impermanence, uncertain, then the mind starts making plans and moving and trying to make it secure again somehow. And of course that's where these characteristics tie in with each other, or they're part of a whole. What is impermanent is also unsatisfactory. What is impermanent, unsatisfactory, really is not suitable to be taken as, this is who I am, this is me, this is mine, this is not self. So that they function together, they work together. But in terms of practice, and in terms of as we hold, we use it in practice. It's when we're sitting or developing our meditation, tuning into our experience and what's the state of the mind, is it in a place of balance? Is it clear? Do we bring up a reflection? And there's different ways that one can do that. It's just like sometimes it's just through analyzing, investigating, and is there impermanence here? Is this something satisfactory? Is this stable? Is this solid? And then the mind can put it down and relinquish it. Other times, it's just as the mind becomes still and settled, it's just sort of like dropping a seed of of impermanence. And it can just be, rather than paying attention to the breath as an object for settling and focusing, is paying attention to the breath as an a model or example of uncertainty, of impermanence. The sensations that we experience, the more you tune in, the more you start to see that, well, these are clusters of experience that are rising and ceasing within that sphere, just within an in-breath. Yeah. And so that recognizing that change, that uncertainty, that impermanence within that simple sensation, so that these truths are displaying itself, and then it's okay. Well, that's an example of that. This is something. And then our moods or our thought that arises in the mind. It's like really, this is really helpful to bring up that question. You have a thought come up in the mind, a memory of somebody, and it could be eliciting some kind of painful memory, pleasant memory, and is it certain? Yeah. You think, wow, it's when you question it and you look at it, it's not so certain, not so sure. The thoughts, the moods, the feelings, these are all constantly changing and shifting, and to be able to, rather than trying to pin it down so that you can be absolutely sure about this particular mood or feeling, it's like, no, this is exactly the display of uncertainty, of anicca, of impermanence, of change. And then it can be relinquished. And that's where one comes back to this quality of knowing, being the witness. That's where one's taking refuge in the... This is where one takes refuge in the Buddha. Being the one who knows, having a refuge in awakening, in awakening to the truth of that experience. The heart settles, it clears. The Buddha points to the results of the when these insights are the directing of attention in this way, and so that they, when we contemplate anicca, the kind of emancipation of mind, or the flavor of the mind as it's, when it sees anicca clearly, is what's called animitta vimokkha. It's a liberation or emancipation through signlessness, in the sense that because one sees the uncertain, shifting, changing nature of phenomena, then one doesn't fixate on these signs or images or cues that the senses give or the mind gives, when one can turn to a signless liberation. So it's like knowing the experience, but not being sucked into its particulars. One can not reacting to the particulars of that of experience. One knows and sees clearly, but it's a one can dwell in the signless. So it's a flavor that arises with that contemplation of anicca. That contemplation of dukkha and insight with the flavor that comes is what's called apanahita vimokkha. It's the liberation through desirelessness. So that when one sees the inherent dis-ease, unsatisfactoriness of conditions, then the heart can rest in a quality of desirelessness, in the sense that that's our natural response to the world around us. And we say there's usually some kind of desire functioning. It's like when one time somebody came to ask Ajahn Chah sort of, and it was cast in kind of a bit philosophical. Maybe the person was a bit full of themselves, and please, Ajahn Chah, tell me the central teaching of the Buddhas. And so, what is the central principle of the Lord Buddha's teachings? And Ajahn Chah sort of had, say, like this, so you've got this this bell ringer here, this stick, something like that. Ajahn Chah picks it up and said, is this a big stick or a little stick? and of course the person's confused. He's asking about the central principles of the Lord Buddha's teachings. And Ajahn Chah is, is this a big stick or a little stick? And the person says, I don't understand. And Ajahn Chah said, if you wanted to pick your teeth, you'd say this was a big stick because you wanted a smaller one. But if you wanted to build a house, you'd say that this is a small stick because it doesn't fit your desire of what you want. And that's the central principle of Buddhism, is that we're constantly, our desire is what is running ahead of us all the time, creating our experience, creating our perceptions, creating our image of the world around us and ourselves. And to be able to understand that desire and then to access this quality of desirelessness. This incredible stillness of insight, because one's not moving towards things, one's not trying to create and build and become. So that apanahita vimokkha, that contemplation of dukkha, is not to make yourself miserable. It's to give you an opportunity to not feed or buy into the habit of desire. The contemplation of anatta is the say liberation, sunyata vimokkha, so liberation through emptiness. And the emptiness is not a metaphysical emptiness or a nihilistic emptiness. It's an emptiness of self. And it's just not having to carry that sense of I, me, and mine position. And and it doesn't take much to reflect and say every time there's been a feeling of discomfort, dis-ease, conflict, problem, it's this I position, it's the me, this is mine. How dare you do that? It's out of that I position. So that recognizing that inherent emptiness, it's sort of like when somebody, it's Ajahn Chah sort of saying, like the worst thing you could call somebody is a dog in Thai language, and that's really bad. That's, you know, if you really want to curse and revile somebody, you call them a dog. And Ajahn Chah sort of, you say, you know, if you didn't carry around a self-position, and somebody called you a dog, all you need to do is look and see if you've got a tail. If you got a tail, it's a problem. You know? But that's otherwise, it's just that's empty. It's not. It doesn't have a basis in reality, so one doesn't need to hold it. And that's that liberation of emptiness. See, the emptiness of the positions that we take, so that our freedom comes in seeing that clearly. So as the using these anicca and dukkha anatta, not as just labels that you kind of slap on experience and sort of, and if you sort of, if I call it anicca dukkha anatta enough, I should get an insight. One has to be bringing it in, internalizing it, contemplating it, feeling it, experiencing it, reflecting on it, contemplating its implications, in delighting in the possibilities that are possible. When the mind, when we give it the opportunity to shift and change, give it the opportunity to release and relinquish. Ajahn Chah gave a couple images that always resonate with me in the when using the investigation and contemplation of anicca dukkha anatta, and one was he said it's like waves coming into the shore at the seaside, and it's like the waves coming in, whether they're small waves, big waves. If one's by the seaside, then there's always going to be these waves coming in, breaking on the shore, and going out again. And that he said, our contemplation is learning to be just like the shore itself. That's sort of the stable base that receives all these waves. And the waves come in, whether they're small or they're big, or whether they come in rapidly or they come in slowly. Our duty, our responsibility is to be present for that, to know it, to recognize it, to see it clearly, and to be as solid and steady as that seashore. And we can do that. We can be steady and present. The other image, another image that I always found striking was the image that Ajahn Chah used of the a spider in its web, and saying that the way a spider works, of course, it weaves its web, and once it's got its web woven, it sits in the middle, and it waits. And then whenever a insect comes by, strikes that web, then it runs out, wraps it up in its silk, and that's its, brings it back to the middle, and that's its food, its nourishment, that's how it lives. That in the same way as practitioners, we have our web of mindfulness and wisdom, that we attend to the sense contact. So whenever there's sight, sound, smells, taste, touch, mental objects arise, and we have our mindfulness and wisdom that is in the center, sort of goes out, receives those impressions, takes them, wraps them up in anicca, dukkha, anatta, and brings them back to the center again, and that's how we say, that's how we live, how we practice, how we cultivate this path, so that using those simple truths, or simple these characteristics of existence, and they form a basis of our training, and they lay the foundation for our experiencing the fruits of that training, of that practice, that to be bringing this in and reflecting, and one of the comes up from just again something that we chant in the morning chanting, Adi Kalyanam, Mache Kalyanam, Pariyosana Kalyanam, which is sort of like this path is, and this practice is beautiful in the beginning, beautiful in the middle, beautiful in the end. And let's say as we practice and train. And another kalyana can be beautiful, can good. It's good in the beginning, good in the middle, good in the end. So that laying these foundations for the our beginnings, our and middle and end of the practice, being consistent in the practice, applying oneself to the different aspects of the path, so that it's able to bear fruit appropriately. So offer that for reflection this morning, and we can sit quietly.